and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had a life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest for me, a political hero of mine from the band Grievous Angel, from the band L'Etranger, from the riding of Timmins, James Bay, and from the New Democratic Party, the first ever sitting member of Canadian Parliament to be on the show. First ever member of Canadian Parliament to be on the show. Someone I would vote for if I could. Charlie Angus is here on the show, and we are here to talk about what else? Punk. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Left4Damian. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just by telling all your friends about it, letting everyone know that you enjoy the podcast that we do here each and every week. You can also support the show by subscribing to it and rating it on iTunes, and thank you. To everyone that does do that. You can also support it by heading over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. And a huge, huge shout out to everyone that does do that. And check out some of the stuff we put up on there. There's video editions of some of the episodes. A lot of the episodes now, actually, to be honest with you. There's also footnotes and unreleased episodes and other stuff. So thank you to everyone that heads over there and checks that out. And speaking of support, this show would not be possible without the kind support of the fine folks at Vans who came aboard a few years ago and said, Damian, we love what you do. We just don't love that you have to do it out of your own pocket. So they helped me cover the costs of doing this thing. And for that, I am very appreciative. And one day, I long to be back at the House of Vans parties where I used to go and do the occasional live podcast and see a show. And we'll get there. We'll get there one day. Speaking of getting there, Fucked Up is going to be going out on tour with Faith No More for a bunch of outdoor shows. You do need to be vaccinated and all that good stuff. So if you are around and feel safe doing so, come out and see us. Check out some of the dates that are posted online now. You can find, I think there's only 4 dates in total, including Riot Fest. But I'm very excited to be out on there on the road again. Very excited to be out with Faith No More. Speaking of Fucked Up stuff, Fucked Up's going to be reissuing David Comes to Life on Matador Records, and we'll also be going out on tour in support of that in the new year, starting in January, I guess. More information about that can be found at fuckedup.cc. Fucked Up's also putting out an hour and a half long song called Year of the Horse. That is available from my good buddy Scotty Karate at Tank Crimes Records. And finally, Fucked Up's original singles collection, the long out of print, never released on vinyl, Epics in Minutes, is finally going to be getting a full vinyl reissue thanks to our friends at Get Better Records. Please check that out. I'm super stoked that they're going to be doing it. I'm very happy to be on that label. And yeah, this thing looks awesome. I can't believe it's going to be a 12-inch. This is the only record that Fucked Up ever did that I had like a hand in designing. So can't wait to see this thing as a 12-inch. Anyway, that is that. On to today's show. Now, today on the show, as I said off the top, it's a political hero of mine. Also a musical hero. He plays in Grievous Angel, an incredible band that have put out not a brand new record, but a new record called Summer Before the Storm. It is fantastic. You can find that everywhere now. It is on the Jimmy Boyle Records label. And it is a fantastic thing. This episode was supposed to come out a long time ago. And I have to apologize to my friend Melanie Kay, who hit me up about doing this episode. I told her it was a dream episode to happen on the show. And we did it. And then unfortunately, there was a hard drive disaster, which I've alluded to in the past. I lost a lot of episodes. I thought this might be one of them. But recently found another copy of this file. And am very stoked that you get to hear it. Because in addition to playing a Grievous Angel, Charlie was also a member of L'Etranger, a sort of second wave Toronto band, a key second wave Toronto band, also featuring former member of Parliament from the NDP party, Andrew Cash, who writes a new song on the brand new Grievous Angel record with Charlie as well. But L'Etranger has always been a band that has fascinated me, being that it has not one, but two members of Parliament in that band. And I just had to talk to Charlie. And so Melanie made it happen. And now you finally get to hear it. Now, the way it works in Canada, we have an election coming up. And you vote for the person in your riding to be your member of Parliament. And if you're lucky, that person is part of the political party that forms the majority and thus makes the government. And, you know, they get to appoint the Senate, and they get to appoint or additional senators. They get to appoint the governor general. It functions a little bit differently in Canada than in, you know, America and other places. It's a parliamentary system. We do not get to a vote for our executive. Anyway, the reason I'm explaining all this is because we do have an election coming up in Canada. And if you are in Canada, I implore you to look at the issues, look at the people in your riding and decide who you're going to vote for. If I was able to, if I was in Timmins and James Bay, I would be voting for Charlie Angus because he definitely falls in line on all the issues that I fall in line on, as you will hear in this episode. But this is, I'm not telling you how to vote. You know, I'm just telling you, you know, read up on this stuff, get informed on this stuff. And I'm honored that I get to have Charlie on the show. So I'm not going to ramble on anymore. There's a lot to get to. Once again, please check out the Grievous Angel record, Summer Before the Storm, when you get a chance, because it is a fantastic record. Check out L'Etranger. We talk about so many great bands that are even obscure in Canada, even obscure in Toronto. And this is where all these bands are from. But anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Here is, I think we say the Right Honorable Charlie Angus on Turned Out a Punk. Charlie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I'm really into being on the show with you. I'm really glad you're having me on, and let's get down to it.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, not only am I a fan of your music, but also, you know, I vote with the party, so I feel like I'm politically and sonically in line with you. So it's an, you know, it works on two levels having you here.
Well, perfect. And politics and music, to me, punk was an avenue for that. That taught me how those things are so interconnected, and they've been interconnected in my life ever since.
Well, we're going to get there, but I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Charlie, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
I remember in grade 10 accounting class, sitting at the back of the room, and I couldn't figure out why one line under this number was more important than two lines, and why my columns didn't add up. And everybody else was acing it, and I was looking out the window thinking there's a better world out there. And I started to read. My neighbor was giving me magazines from England, and I was reading about the Sex Pistols. And I was thinking, what the hell's going on in the world? And I went to the local record shop in the suburban mall, because we had moved from, my family was from Timmins, but we had moved to Scarborough. And there was the first Clash album, the first Sex Pistols album. And I bought those albums, and the woman at the counter said, "Oh my God, you're not going to buy that, are you?" And I thought, man, I am like holding kryptonite here. I don't know what it sounds like. I don't know what it is, but I know there's something powerful here. And those records, after that, the world was no longer beige and brown. It was full of color. It was full of opportunity. It was full of ideas. And we didn't, I think, you know, being sort of in that, not, I wasn't quite in the very first break of punk. We were kids under that age group. Mm-hmm. But what I really try and say to people is that people think of punk now as like mohawks and studs and a look and Doc Martens. What was really great about punks, we didn't have any of that. We didn't know what punk was. We just knew that it wasn't, we knew what we didn't like. And so punk was a doorway into other things. It was an opportunity to think outside the box, to maybe it's poetry, maybe it's art, maybe it's queer politics, maybe it's just playing things really loud, but it's not what we've been told is the way to go. And to me, punk was always a way of rethinking the world where you actually have some power to make decisions.
Yeah, I think that's what I love most about the Toronto scene, or like, you know, the greater Toronto scene at that time, is that you have a band like yourselves, you have Fifth Column, you've got the Rent Boys Inc., you've got the BFGs, and everyone is punk rock, but no one sounds the same and no one's doing it the same way.
There was a lot of differences in the sound. There were a lot of clubs, and there was a lot of hierarchies. You know, there was the art school crowd. There was like more of a mod sound. There were like, I think L'Étranger, our influences were kind of funny because we were definitely politically influenced by the Clash. The Jam were a huge influence on us, but we were probably the only punk band at the time that would go to acoustic guitars in the middle of the set, which is very interesting, I think, considering where the Grievous Angels ended up. But that came from other influences like Neil Young. And for me, growing up with, I grew up on Irish rebel music. And so there was a lot of, the Toronto scene was really interesting. It was a real cauldron of bubbling things that I don't think any of us knew how to play properly at the time. I think a lot of the musicians that came out of that scene went on to form other bands that probably became better and more articulate. But it was that kids came out. Kids came out because there was nothing else to do. You know, we didn't have we didn't have cell phones. We had posters. So people were trying, and they didn't hardly know how to play, and it made it exciting. I think some of the most exciting shows I've ever seen are by performers that people today might not even have ever heard of.
Yeah, it's also amazing how much punk rock and sort of like this new music scene changed like the physical landscape of Toronto. Like, just, you know, prior to punk rock, Queen Street Rest versus, you know, by 1982, how that had changed so much. Like, that street was pretty much opened up by punks and people playing in clubs.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. It's my daughters. I have two daughters live in Toronto, and I do a lot of grieving when I'm in Toronto, because I remember walking down club streets where there were club after club after club of live music. And, you know, I mean, high-powered capitalism and real estate and losers like John Tory, who sign off on the developers all the time, chase that out. And beautiful clubs like the Matador get turned into, you know, like, how many more Shoppers Drug Marts do we need on the main floor on great streets in Toronto? When there were a lot of, I think that was the other thing that made Toronto really exciting at that time, was it wasn't all that expensive to get a dive. You know, you had young punk artists like King E. Carpenter, who could be right at Queen and Spadina doing her thing. What's that village now down at Dufferin and
Liberty
Dufferin
Village.
And King? Liberty Village, yeah. Was a dump.
Yeah.
We practiced there for $350 a month. Every punk was down there. It was like the only thing you could eat down there. They didn't have fancy bistros. They had a Subway. It wasn't even a chain. It was like a Greek family who sold subs, and that's where you ate from. But that's where music and art was being created from, because you could get a cheap space. People could set up cheap shops. People tried clubs. I think it's really, really difficult to have a creative scene when the costs of being creative are so daunting for young people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's amazing doing the show. You know, like, I've had people come on from Sweden, you know, and there's this huge, massive explosion of music that happens in the mid late 90s in Sweden. Like, bands, you know, go all over the world. But if you trace it back, like, all these bands were a direct result of having these government funded practice spaces and government funded recording spaces for all these bands to kind of get culture. Like, you have to feed it for it to grow, you know, like, you have to have that soil, like, you know, cheap art spaces, cheap rent in order for art to kind of flourish.
Yeah, because I think the really important thing about being creative and about building culture is the power to make mistakes. To try, you know, to rent a space and decide you're going to create a shop and it fails. I talk, you know, again, my youngest daughter, and the pressure that's on them, you know, the zero tolerance, like, of people who go to university. I mean, all the people I knew went to university and dropped out the first year and tried something different. That wasn't a big deal, but now it is. And what it does is it crushes the beautiful, I think this, I mean, Toronto Toronto was known internationally because it was such a flowering place of, you know, it was reggae, it was jazz, it was punk, it was folk, it became into hip hop. Like there was like all those possibilities happened because musicians could actually, I mean, I had a day job. I was a dishwasher. Andrew Cash was a busboy. Mm-hmm. We practiced 30 hours a week as a band because we weren't very good. But like punk bands, you know, you would start out, you'd get a job, you'd play nights. And the multitude of opportunities to play, to work your craft, to me, that's the other thing. It's not having one place or two places, but having so many places. So if you really bomb in one place, the next club might actually let you try again, and then you get better. And I mean, you know, that to me is a DIY experience of like learning your craft and your life in front of an audience, and kids coming out or an audience coming out and being willing to either put up with you or boo you off the stage. To me, that was about once a year, the Parliament, Library of Parliament calls my staff and says, we noticed that Mr. Angus doesn't put any of his academic credentials down. And my assistant, Janet, she's great. She calls into me and she says, Charlie, it's the same question. Do you want me to get the same answer? And I said, yeah, tell them I went to Punk Rock University and got my degrees. They've never put it up on the parliamentary website, but I keep tell them I graduated from Punk Rock University, and then we can. They've never done that though. They don't seem to think it's an official university. It was. It totally was.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, there are many people that have come out of that university. You know, like we talk about this scene and all these people that you mentioned, you know, go on to play in other bands or like yourselves in Andrew Cash or in politics, or went on like the people from Fifth Column to become great artists, or, you know, like it is a scene that draws a certain type of creative individual to it and says, you know, gives them permission to kind of go out and create and go out and make something. And there's not very many places that do that to a young person.
Well, I think that was the great thing about that scene. I met a young guy wanted to, you know, study art, and he said, oh yeah, my art teacher knows you. And I said, how does she know me? And he said, well, she was the bass player in the band Restless Virgins. It's like, yeah, remember those guys? We played a number of shows with them, and now she's this incredible artist. And then my wife says, oh, you know her? She's this like I think that it's the tactile nature of getting up on a stage, of getting over your fears, of making mistakes, of having the mics not work, of people have throwing bottles at you or heckling you, that makes you decide, am I an amateur? Am I just doing this for a lark? Or do I actually believe I have something to say? And maybe I think the great people who came out of that scene realized, well, maybe it wasn't music that was what they wanted to say. Maybe it was something else. But that punk opportunity of saying, this is a chord, this is another chord, this is a third chord, now go form a band, to me was a revolutionary way of seeing the world. And I still in the politics I do and wearing a suit and all that, that ability, that belief of just, let's just do it. We can do this. We can make it happen. And then you'd make it happen.
I guess going back to the, you know, the beginning of this sort of punk rock academia journey, like you mentioned that neighbor that was giving you British music magazines, were they just someone that was into music, or were they also kind of getting into punk rock? Like how did they enter your life?
The neighbors, actually, it was funny. My parents, like we were from Timmins, you know, mining town. My parents were children of miners. My dad got a job in Toronto. We moved to Scarborough in the 70s. So like a lot of our neighbors were Jamaican. So we were listening. They were playing. They were like, that was the first time I heard of reggae music. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and reggae was, I think, the other part of it. Reggae was this incredibly powerful political force. But across the road was, I loved him. His name was Mike Glass. He was a postal worker who just had this amazing record collection. And you know, Mike was big and loud, but Mike had, he had music magazines from England. He had Melody Maker, we'd babysit for his kids, and he would give us the Melody Makers. And I remember seeing like Elvis Costello on the cover. Now Elvis Costello is like Mr. Respected, but when you first saw Elvis Costello with the My Aim Is True look, I mean, that was the most radical breaking down of the cool rock thing. Like, we didn't even know what we were like, who is this guy? What is this? Yeah. And, and so the neighbor, the postie across the road was giving us these magazines, Cream Magazine, and reading about the Sex Pistols and what was going on. And it was such an affront to the world of, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer and, Scarborough. I know people get very offended now when I make fun of Rush, but my God, like all the guys I knew growing up with their kimonos and their like wanting to write in 5/8 time and write about Ayn Rand and all that crap. And we were like, what is this? And suddenly it was like, oh, there's a band called The Jam. Like, we could be them instead of Rush. And we wouldn't have to go out and buy BC Rich basses and have to spend all our money on expensive stuff. We could just get a cheap Trainer monoblock. I'll get a cheap bass. Andrew will get a guitar. And we'll write some songs. So, you know, that's how simple it was. It was like you saw something in a magazine. You heard 45s, like the English Beat. We didn't even know what they looked like. We played their records over and over and over and thought, wow, maybe we can do this.
Well, you mentioned Elvis Costello there and just how shocking that would have been. And it's like, it's wild to think now, because we're like, you know, in a post Weezer kind of world, but like just how, what an affront to like Robert Plant, Elvis Costello's whole vibe would have been, you know, just like everything about it is just the opposite of what you're told a rock star is supposed to look like at that point.
Well, I think that's the other really important element, is that punk wasn't just rebelling against, you know, the Margaret Thatcher Reagan world at the time. It was also calling out what had happened to rock and roll, mm-hmm. that rock and roll had become so smug and so established and so pompous. And I think one of the really, sellout things of what happened over the years is a lot of people who got that punk aesthetic then it went into the industry and then flipped it to the advantage. So that the industry was always being relentlessly cool and relentlessly bad boy. But even when it wasn't, it was incredibly corporate. But there was a time when groups like the Sex Pistols could really screw with the corporate brain's trust that, you know, these corporations had. They couldn't get their heads around this music. A lot of these bands, I remember the first time we played L'Étranger, that was our first punk band with Andrew. We played in Ottawa at the Roxy Club, and there was a lineup around the block to see us. And we were coming from Toronto to Ottawa, and we were stunned. And it was because CKCU was the local radio station, and CKCU had a transmitter that could be heard all through the city. Mm-hmm. So all these young kids came out to see us, and there was a guy from the local Q, you know, the Q92 kind of radio station. And he was a big fan, and he was backstage and he was hanging out all night. And I looked at him and I said, so do you play us? And he goes, oh no, I'm not allowed to play you. And I said, then what are you doing at our show? And he goes, well, I love music, but our station hates music. We play Kansas. We play Boston. We play. And I said, man, oh man. He goes, I know. He said, this is what we are. And so like, I see a lot of bands now, like, I don't think that they have the same kind of huge wall limits that existed then, that there were like genres that you couldn't cross over. I think one of the positive things now is that music just is moving. It moves in all forms. But back then there were walls and you couldn't cross over that wall. And punk was about blowing those walls up.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, look how it changed just the way people approach touring, right? Like, you're mentioning going around, sleeping on people's floors, playing squats, and just doing that kind of touring. Like, that's entirely because of punk rock, that sort of, you know, advancement in culture, in like, you know, disbursement of culture, I guess.
I think it really is. I think that whole DIY thing, I mean, we were really excited by the digital opportunities, you know, before it bankrupted us all. But part of it was that, and I always say to people, you know, it wasn't all that, you know, we think of these days when people, you know, had value for records. Yeah, they did, but nobody had ever, like, the record companies wouldn't put us in their stores. Mm-hmm. The only records we ever sold was out of the back of a van. And so the issue for punk was like, the labels are never going to promote us. We're never going to get on mainstream radio. We're never going to get stocked in the stores. So we can either sit here and cry, or we can get in a van and tour. And that was, you know, how many great bands across North America just built their careers touring. And every one of those tours, they created in their wake 100 great other bands. And yeah. I think that was the thing. And now we all have Bandcamp and everybody's learned to, you know, create their own. I think that what we've lost is actually being able to get paid for the music that we do. We can work that one out. I think we're going to be okay.
Yeah. And I think it's also that, like you're talking about, that face-to-face community building that goes on when you're playing from town to town, where you're actually, you know, in the best case scenario, inspiring people firsthand to kind of go out and do it themselves. And, you know, like you hear stories about those early Black Flag tours, you know, or where they would go and they play somewhere. And then, you know, 6 months later, there's a little scene that's kind of cropped up and it's in their wake.
I think that's really an important thing. And it's, you know, in my work is in politics and in music, what I came to really understand is that, like, by playing shows and singing about things to an audience, that audience told us stories. You know, it was in between sets. You know, the fans would call us over and they would tell us stories about their lives, and because they thought nobody had ever cared about what they lived before. And for me as a writer, I actually tried to write those into other songs, so the songs became a reflection of the audience. And so I always think, like, especially with the Grievous Angels, we were totally a live music band. We played every crazy bar, any kind of scene, anywhere. Mm-hmm. And people think, okay, you're the band and they're the audience. But for me, we were the audience. We were watching people live their lives on a Saturday night, their hopes, their fights, their frustrations, their ups, their downs. And they would always, it was in between sets, being pulled over to tables and people talking to us. The funniest, of course, is, you'd know, people trying to talk to you when the other band is playing so loud you can't hear anything, and there's someone's, like, it's almost like a needle in your ear because someone's screaming at, trying to be heard because they want to tell you something. All those stories, like, to me, that's what feeds an artist.
Yeah, no, you're right. Like, it's definitely like it's really weird now being stuck at home trying to write, where you don't have that kind of inspiration that you get from being out hearing people's stories.
Yeah. You know, so much of what I've written, especially with the Grievous Angels being more of sort of a voice for, you know, working class people, is that they were stories that were told to us by an audience that trusted us. And so we played their crazy nights and their fun nights, and you know, and then the nights when there were six people in the bar. I always remember driving, I don't know how many hundred, from Toronto to Windsor, 500 kilometers, and you know, a sign said band playing tonight. Whenever you see a sign that says band playing tonight, you know it's going to be a bad night. And it's like, there's nobody in there. And it's like, okay, guys, either we're going to get drunk or we're going to give them the best show they've ever had. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's that punk rock spirit. It's like, it doesn't matter if there's 3,000, 10,000 or three, you're there to play. And the amateurs and the ones who are the, you know, the punters who come and go, they might decide to act foolish and act like an idiot. But if you take your craft seriously, there's three people there. I remember one night, it was like, we traveled, I don't know how many hundreds of kilometers. And we were like, we're going to give this crowd the best. They're going to die when they see us. And we were like two songs into it, and one couple got up and left. And we were like, okay, now we're down to two people. Okay, we're still going to do the show. And if they leave, we're going to play it for ourselves, right? Like that to me is like, that's what music's about. Like, you do it for the love of the music.
What was the first concert you went to?
First concert I went to, the first thing that ever blew my mind, I was in grade 9, and that was when bands were still, the big rocker bands were still playing the high school tours, mm-hmm. shows, and Max Webster played at our high school, and became, you know, Kim Mitchell, of course.
Oh,
became,
absolutely, yeah.
But the first incarnation of Max Webster was just such a weird they were doing a lot more like the Alex Harvey band, doing a lot of different stuff. And I was just really fascinated by what they were doing, and fell in love with them. I think most of the rockers at our school thought they were real weird and didn't like them. Of course, Kim Mitchell then later became Arena Rock, but so that was pretty much the first show I'd seen. But the first punk shows, I was at the last Pogo. I was 15. I don't know why they even let me into the club. I was at the last Pogo, and at that point, then it was no looking back. We were like 16, 17 going to shows at Toronto punk bars, and nobody carded you back then. And there were so many great acts that came. I remember standing outside a bar on Yonge Street when Madness played, and we listened to them outside because we were underage, and you couldn't get into a bar underage on Yonge Street, but you could if it was Larry's Hideaway or the other bars or The Edge, which was like an amazing. We tried to get into the Police one night, my girlfriend and I, and I hate the Police, I gotta say, but we thought we'd go see them, but we couldn't get in. But normally in those days, you could say, well, I don't want to see the band, I want to go hang out in the back, and then go into the back, and then you go in and watch the band. So, yeah, we saw a lot of really great bands.
It's funny you bring up Max Webster there, and I think like Max Webster, Rough Trade, even like that first Rush record, like there's almost this weird bend to Toronto rock music just prior to punk happening. Like there's almost like this like proto weird rock thing that's not sonically there, but like it's not
totally
quite normal.
totally. Yeah, and I mean, you know, I diss Rush because they became so big, but the early Rush were so Toronto, and they influenced everybody. I mean, the Real Statics, God, if I said that to the Real Statics, they'd punch me. And I love the Real Statics. They opened for us all, you know, before they became really big, but those bands were all really influential. Like we were like 17 and we played our first big thing was some kind of like Battle of the Bands thing. And Greg Godovitz from Gatto was one of the judges. And he brought us on the road with him. We were like playing like heavy. We were playing heavy duty biker bars, and we were like kids. We didn't know how to play. Like they had to send bouncers with us to go to the washroom because they thought the crowd was going to beat us up. But the crowd the crowd was very protective of us because we were like these 110-pound skinny punk kids, yeah. And they thought it was really cute. But like Godovitz, like there was the Toronto scene. It was different, you know? And so I think we were like picking up a lot of different influences and a lot of those things. And certainly if you listen to the Real Statics, I think a lot of those influences are really, you can really trace them. That sort of mixture of rock, the prog rock, there were some really, really cool, different Canadian things happening. And I think again, what the great thing about early punk was that none of it was really defined. We were just, trying to figure out what fit and what didn't. And we'd try different things and some things worked and some things didn't.
So when you guys first started playing, like you mentioned being part of the sort of the second wave of bands, who were some of the other bands that were from that wave? Like, you know, like were there other bands from Scarborough before you guys started playing Downtown more?
Yeah. I mean, we were, I think there was a whole bunch of kids, like the older groups was like Vile Tones, you know, they were probably mid-20s. We thought they were ancient. We were about 17, Teenage Head, the Diodes, the Demics were like, I think that record was the greatest punk record ever made. Like we just listened to it over and over and over again. And then we came along. So it was L'Étranger, the Real Statics came along, Kinetic Ideals, the Rent Boys, there was a ton of bands then that came out. Fifth Column, we played with all those groups. Like we played, I don't know how many countless shows with them, but it was also the bars. Like you had Larry's Hideaway was this, it was such a trashy dive. And I've thought a lot about Larry's because upstairs was a pretty grotty drug prostitute place. And downstairs were all these kids. But they were really protective of us. It was sort of like, I remember them saying, it was, don't you look at what goes on upstairs. You keep your nose out and you go downstairs and play your show and don't, you know, like they were pretty tough guys who ran the place, but no kids ever got caught up in that world that was upstairs. There was a kid's world downstairs, and we were all under 19. And Cabana Room was the big one. I think that Cabana Room for a lot of bands was, you know, lowest of the low open for us. The Sky Diggers came out of Directive 17. Jason Collette and Lazy Grace was his band. The Cabana Room, if you talk to, I think, any Toronto band from that time, the Cabana Room and Jimmy Scopus, the Greek owner, was he gave so many bands an opportunity to just try things out.
Where was the Cabana Room? I've never heard of this venue.
The Cabana Room was the Spadina Hotel at King and Spadina.
Okay. Yeah.
Upstairs. Oh, wow. And it was like a 1940s, it was like a 1940s drinking establishment gone downhill. Mm-hmm. And it was run by Jimmy the Greek, Jimmy Scopus. And then what Jimmy did was after this, like we played, all the bands played there. Like any band that came out at that time, this Cabana Room, Jimmy was like our Greek dad. But when we came back with our second itineration of bands, like from L'Etranger, I came back with Grievous Angels. Jimmy would give us like, he'd say, okay, I need you boys to do Wednesday nights. Can you do a whole Wednesday nights from 2 months, all summer? I need Wednesday night covered. We're like, that's a lot. Jimmy goes, well, I take it or leave it. So we took all Wednesdays. And then Andrew Cash started Monday Night Meltdowns, Acoustic Meltdowns. And again, we were like, I think we were all retooling from the punk thing and and starting to go into different directions. So Andrew Cash started this Monday Night Meltdown, Acoustic Meltdown. And it was all acoustic music and fiddle. You had Jim Ettinger, who's an incredible fiddler, who's on a couple of his albums. And then that's when Andy Mays and Josh started the Sky Diggers thing going. And then Pete Cash, like a whole bunch of acts came out and thought, well, maybe we'll just try a couple of acoustic songs. And so that was a real natural transition from a lot of the punk bands had been playing those bars, that you'd get these gigs at the Spadina to just try something different. And you know, the Angels, when we first started doing our Wednesday night, we weren't doing that much original. We were doing like Hank Williams and Patsy Cline and Clancy Brothers, and you know, we did a Led Zeppelin song on accordion, and we were just trying a bunch of, and Stompin' Tom was the other huge, I think, push that drove us to alt, like that sort of alt country thing. Johnny Cash was punk.
Yep.
But Stompin' Tom was Canadian punk. And that was really the Radio Statics were really with Stompin' Tom then. And I, cause I'd grown up on Stompin' Tom, and again, now Stompin' Tom is like this Canadian icon. He was like considered, he'd stopped playing. He was the guy that, you know, the cool people made fun of, and our punk generation rediscovered him and said, no, this guy's the real deal. He's our Woody Guthrie. He's our Johnny Cash. So, you know, we were all like wanting to learn Stompin' Tom songs. That's where we met with the guys from UIC, and all this stuff started to just percolate into taking punk into a different realm, which is with me, obviously became the Grievous Angels.
It also feels like that's what punk was always about. Like, you know, rediscovering the stuff that had been thrown away from music's past. Like you're saying, Stompin' Tom, like that goes back to the Horseshoe, like his, you know, legendary live nights at the Horseshoe Tavern.
I really think it is. It's, I mean, punk was about reggae, but punk was about rockabilly. Like I remember going into Long and McQuaid's when the place was full of like, you know, all the long hairs wanting to do Stairway to Heaven. And I had a Gene Vincent record. I didn't even know who Gene Vincent was, but I knew it was cool. And I knew it was cool because everyone was like, what the hell's that? I said, it's Gene Vincent. And it was like, they didn't know if he was new or what. Like, so, you know, and I always remember an amazing night. My mom and I went to see Johnny Cash and the Carter Family one time at Ontario Place. And there were all these like older people like my mom. And I couldn't believe it, a whole bunch of punks, a whole bunch of young leather jackets, right?
Yeah.
It was like going to see Peter Tosh. They were all Jamaicans, and suddenly there were all these young punk kids going to see Toots and the Maytals. It was a huge Jamaican audience and like 12 white kids in leather jackets, right? Like the punk was, and the Clash were I think, an encyclopedia of music for us, because they made us think in other ways. They pushed us to think things we weren't necessarily going to hear, to say, listen to it. Like Magnificent Seven, that whole funk sound made us listen to stuff. And I think that that was really, I think to me that, so when people say, oh, punk rock, you don't sound punk rock. It's like, punk's an attitude. Punk's a way of seeing the world. It's not what, how loud you play the chord. It's how you approach that chord and think, what can that chord do?
How long after you formed the band did Innocent Hands get recorded?
Innocent Hands was recorded.
It comes out in 82, I think, right?
Yeah. So we were, I remember us all saying, we were like, we were like saying one time, you know, the Jam had their first album when they're 18, and like, we're almost like 20 years old and we're complete failures. And so we formed in around 1980, we quit school, and 1982, we had Innocent Hands out. Yeah. That was, I think, that and that first album, the third record, I think, are the high points of L'Étranger. The second one, we were trying a whole bunch of stuff. We were Gang of Four. We were trying, Talking Heads. A lot of stuff just didn't work out. But there was a sound that really coalesced what became, I think, a very clear L'Étranger sound. And then I was moving into other sounds. I was really, really interested in going back to rootsy kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Grievous Angels is a more natural fit at that point.
It feels like that was like a lot of the Queen Street scene too. Like you look at like someone like Handsome Ned or even Blue Rodeo. Like it feels like there was a, after, you know, almost the last pogo, there's like a return or like a search for like, what is the true punk? Like what is the sound beyond the aggression that is punk?
I think it, you know, to us, like, and I often joke about the band, the name, the Grievous Angels. When we picked the Grievous Angels, there hadn't been a Graham Parsons revival as of yet. Mm-hmm. If I had known there was going to be a huge Graham Parsons revival, I would have never picked the name Grievous Angels, because yeah. It's like we've been stuck with it ever since. There's about 39 Grievous Angels bands out there, and people keep saying, oh, you're a Graham Parsons cover band. It's like, no, when we literally, Graham had died, and like, people, like, like, I think Andrew Cash's older brothers knew Graham Parsons and that sort of hippie brothers. But like, a lot of people didn't know him. But Graham was a real natural, I think, transition into that alt country sound. And a whole bunch of, like, Wilco and all these bands were going in that direction. I think it's a really natural thing with punk. Because punk, you know, if you think of like a group like The Clash and how deeply committed they were to roots music. Well, Johnny Cash was as punk as it got. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of punk kids just made that switch. They heard rock, they heard Clash and punk and mod music, and then they heard rockabilly, and rockabilly brought them back to a country sound, and that country sound was outlaw music. And I think what punk brought to it is that, I mean, so we always joked with about the Grievous Angels is we were just playing Hank Williams faster and harder, maybe with a little less soul, but we were trying.
Well, I guess speaking of true outlaws, did you have any run-ins, or did you ever have any stories with the Ugly? They're such an infamous band in Toronto around that time.
Yeah, but they were older than us.
They're from the East End too, though, right? Like, well, they're more kind of like Logan and Danforth area type thing.
Yeah, we knew of them, but it was funny because a lot of those bands, like, again, we were like 17. We were probably more mod than those guys, like when we were all like 17-year-olds. And so, yeah, we knew of them, but like we didn't. And there was like this whole gang that went with the Vile Tones, the Blake Street Boys. And
yeah.
Yeah, we were never really in that world at all. Like we sort of were, it does sound really strange that 2 years in one small music scene could create such a difference, but that was how fast and how much things were changing then as well. There was a bunch of stuff happening one after another, and depends where you found yourself or where you woke up.
Yeah, it really feels like you know, you look at it like something like the Smash Tape, and kind of around this period, like you have that early scene you talked about with, like, you know, the Vile Tones and Teenage Head and, like, you know, like Cardboard Brains and very, you know, like this sort of core scene. But then you know, like these 2 years, by that point, you've got, you know, the Kinetic Ideals and all that Mannequin Records stuff. You've got, you know, all the more hardcore stuff that's happening with, you know, Youth and those bands, and then yourselves. Like, it feels like it almost like this explosion that kind of happens.
Yeah. And they were exploding all over the place. Like Youth. We knew those guys really, really well. And we were like, they were that whole hardcore California sound was coming out in a really different way. I think Toronto was unique because it was the older crowd had heard, was focused on New York because that was like television. It was Ramones, you know, the Lou Reed thing. New York was such a natural focus for Toronto, but the London, UK, Manchester sound had a huge influence in Toronto. And then the California thing happened, which was very, very much West Coast, DOA and all those bands, the Subhumans. That was like a whole different world to us. Art Bergman and that sort of West Coast thing was like, there was a real, again, punk had such huge divisions as to whose gang you were in kind of thing. You know, I mean, God, like it's now it all just seems so like we were all in the same gang. But we couldn't tell each other we were in the same gang. So, Youth, I remember. And Young Lions made the huge switch from blew our mind from the Stiff Little Fingers kind of punk reggae to like hardcore. And we were like, what happened there? What did you guys do that for? Like and to them it was natural. To us, it was like, what's going on here? But yeah, there was a lot of really interesting subcultures. And then of course there was a lot of like we used to be really snooty about the art school crowd, but there were some great bands. Like, and they were, some of them were older, like Martha and the Muffins. Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest bands, our biggest influence back then was the Mods.
Yeah. A great band. Absolutely.
Yeah, because I think what blew us away about the Mods, and we didn't really even know at that point that there was a mod movement. We didn't know anything about Mods until Quadrophenia came out. But the thing about the Mods is that their posters were incredible. And again, those are the days when the only way to, you know, you couldn't do text messages. You had posters. L'Étranger was a poster band. We basically buried the city in posters, not ones that came off easy. We had heavy duty glue buckets. People got charged all the time with us. Like, police were always coming after us because we glued our posters onto everything. And one of our big influences was the Mods, and they had these great early 1960s style, like Who, you know, pop posters. And we thought, and artwork was a big thing, and it was so hard to do, like lecture set, and like we didn't have like desktop computers. It was cut and paste stuff. So that band was a big influence on us. They were fun, they were loud, they were poppy, they drove you know, the kids came out and we were like, man, we want to get up on stage and do what they do. Except of course with us, we were a lot more political than them.
Yeah, like it feels like that's definitely something that kind of comes in with that second wave of bands, is there's like a lot more of an overt political awareness, or like overt, like in all sorts of parts of the scene too. Like there's a lot more sort of like awareness of politics with that second wave of bands.
Yeah. And I think I've been thinking a lot about this lately. Like people look back on the 80s, kind of like the way people looked on the 50s as this fun time. And, you know, they had goofy songs and funny clothes and big hair. But the 80s was a very dark time. It was like, it was Reagan, it was Thatcher, it was huge marches in the streets, it was the death squads, you know, that the Americans were paying for in Guatemala. And it felt like politics was a life and death situation. And we were really, like, people went to huge rallies, like the rallies against nuclear weapons. Like there was a real fear that we were moving towards a nuclear showdown, probably the way we hadn't been since the dark points of the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And so it was really something to talk about and to write about. And I think for us as young musicians, and that it just felt really natural. And the other thing, the big battle then was about apartheid. I mean, if you were a musician and you weren't taking a stand on apartheid, you were nobody. Like everybody who was anybody at that point took a stand on apartheid. So L'Étranger was going to win a big award, a big music award through CFNY. And it was being supported by Carlsberg Beer, and Carlsberg Beer was a South African brewery. And we refused to show up for the award ceremony because we were so, maybe because we came out of Catholic school and we were like, really, like if we were going to be, if something was right, we had to be right about it. And we refused to show up for our award. And people were like, oh man, you guys just killed your career. You're never going to live this one down. It was like, yeah, but it's a South African brewery. How can we be talking about apartheid and be getting, you know? So there was all these, there was a lot of politics that I think it was a really dynamic time. And well, I think it's a really dynamic time now. That's why I love Gen Z, man. I am like on fire. I'm like, take you guys go. Like, I'm just, I show up at the rallies and I'm like, this is what I dreamt of.
Yeah, it feels like it's what like punk rock was always talking about is finally here, in terms of like, even when you go to a punk rock show, like now it feels as diverse as punk always said it was. Now, when you see young kids at these shows, like it's definitely a lot more diverse than it was when my band was playing.
Yeah, no, I'm feeling that. I'm feeling like there's something out there. And, you know, of course, COVID has put a big blanket on it. But like, let's remember, just before COVID, we had the largest civil rights movement in Canadian history, civil disobedience. Those marches about the Wet'suwet'en pipeline, mm-hmm. like they were shutting the country down. The power structure was freaking out. Like I remember being in Ottawa and seeing young Indigenous, and they were mostly led by young women, saying, and they had this chant, I don't remember exactly, but it was something like, you know, we're young, we're Indigenous, we're unarmed, and we're unafraid. And they would just walk out onto the main streets and stop all the traffic. I was like, wow, you know, I get to watch this happening. Like, because it's about taking control, and it's about saying we're not afraid, and it's about using the tools that you have. And like those tools of my youngest daughter's the upper end of Gen Z. She's like, Dad, like this young generation doesn't believe they don't believe that the system works for them. And I was thinking that you see those generations that see the cultural break, the political break, the economic uncertainty, and decide, yeah, we're going to just walk across that break and choose something different. Mm-hmm. That's really exciting to watch.
You brought up how political Toronto was back then. And the other thing that's kind of really happening in the 80s, which I think people don't talk about much now, or it's not really looked upon, is just how like that's Toronto was kind of growing up as a city in terms of like, you know, violence, in terms of just urban spread and sprawl that was kind of happening. And you also have the rise of neo-Nazis and the advent of neo-Nazis showing up in the punk scene. Like, did you witness that kind of like coming of violence, coming of like sort of this new, not so great Toronto during that time?
Well, I think one of the huge influences that really drew us in was Rock Against Racism. Mm-hmm. And it was very much like, you know, England had, we're seeing National Front, seeing neo-Nazi, and the attempt to get young punk artists active in Rock Against Racism. We got involved in the Rock Against Racism movement in Toronto at a time when there was a neo-Nazi movement on the move. And I think a lot of young punk kids who just weren't all that politically aware were playing with fascism. Mm-hmm. And we, L'Étranger, we were really hardcore. It's like, you wear a swastika, you get the F out. Like you do not wear a swastika. This is a symbol of mass killing. And there were kids who didn't know that. And then there are kids who I think were playing with it. And we were like, we called that stuff out all the time. I mean, we took our share of abuse and bottles and stuff thrown at us for calling it out at the Dead Kennedys, because the Dead Kennedys drew that crowd. Even though the Dead Kennedys did not, they were adamantly opposed to it. But Rock Against Racism was a big, big thing to sort of say to people, like, it's not cool to be racist. It's not cool to go along with this. You got to shut this stuff down. And I think it played a big part in keeping the punk scene from becoming reactionary. Because I think if we look back on it, particularly the English scene, and then of course what happened in the US, it would have been very easy for the punk movement to become a reactionary, white power movement. Like, it didn't have to be an open-minded movement. It could have been a closed-minded reactionary movement. And it took a lot of work to keep it from becoming that. And we see it now in terms of just the huge dangers that are being caused by disinformation and, you know, the Proud Boys kind of bullshit. But it was definitely there. It was definitely there. And I actually think now, in a way, looking back, and it was definitely what happened in England, a lot of it was anti-Asian as opposed to anti-Black, because the thing about Black was that reggae had a huge influence on the punks. It opened up a lot of punk minds to, like, the Jamaican sounds in Toronto and the Caribbean thing that was happening, because so much of Toronto at that point, Scarborough and that was, there was a huge, you know, Caribbean influence. But a lot of the racism at that time was directed against South Asians that didn't have the same kind of sort of cultural in to the punk community. And I think that was something also that happened in the UK. I mean, the Rock Against Racism had to do a lot of work to say to people, you know, it's being racist is not cool, you know.
Yeah.
wearing one of those British St. George's t-shirts and that sort of skinhead look, like, think about what you're doing.
Well, you brought up that it was a fight, you know, like Rock Against Racism, like the stories you hear about the BFGs going to war with Nazis, like, it was like, there's a reason that that stuff wasn't around in Toronto in sort of any great way in the 90s. It's because people fought so hard to get rid of it in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, and we don't talk about it a lot, but I mean, we used to carry a road crew that was more members. We had more members in our road crew than in the band, and our road crew were all pretty tough guys. Like, Big Nick was our head roadie, and Big Nick was Yugoslavian, and Big Nick had no time for Nazis. And, like, that was that happened, you know. And
yeah,
like our we used to joke. We still joke about it now. They call them the Rude Boys. Like, my road crew. They come to Parliament about once every 2 years, some of the old guys, and all the political staffers say, do you have hired security? Because they're all like nice guys in their 50s now, but they all are pretty still really big guys with leather jackets. And yeah, back in the day, they were like, ah, Chuck, why did you shoot your mouth off? Everything was going good, and then you shot your mouth off about the Nazis. And now look. Then I said, well, thank God you guys were there to get me out of it. So, yeah, there were some, but it had, they had, they, I think it was really important.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Nazis absolutely had to know, you're not welcome here.
Yeah. Well, that's the only.
Yeah. You don't get to come and hang out and be cool. You're not cool. Leave. You leave now and everything's fine. And that was the rule. That was the rule of thumb in all the places we ever played. Nazis, you leave.
Yeah. I remember going to see even a Cro-Mag show, you know, a few years ago, and a Nazi dude showed up, and before anyone could do anything, Steve Goof appeared out of, like, nowhere and threw the guy down the stairs and told him to leave. Like, it was just like, but that's what it takes, you know. Like, it is unfortunately, you know, like a physical thing. Like, I think that's shown by what happened in Toronto in the 80s. Like, it was a war.
Yeah, no, it was definitely. And there was a really great little club called Start Dancing that Vera Bigel and Dan Hughes ran, and it was just kids coming out and dancing to, like, you know, they would play everything from, like, Martha Reeves and the Vandellas to the Jam to punk music, and kids would go dance at it, and every now and then the Nazis would show up, and you know, they were just kids. They didn't have security, and most of the times the Nazis showed up, fortunately my crew was there, right? Like, Big Nick and my brother and his crew, and they were like, time to go, boys. You're not getting in. This isn't your place. You're not allowed here. And then, and often they'd go and pick on some kid down the road and beat him up, right? And it was really bad stuff. But I think that was that sense of solidarity, is that we're drawing the line here. You're not getting in. This isn't going to happen. You're not welcome. And it's the same thing today. We just got to say, you know, what's it? Nazi punks have off, right? Like,
yeah.
Nazis, you're not allowed. And they go away. Like, they go out and they do whatever they do, but we can't let them get in the cultural fabric. And that's the same as what we're seeing, you know, online and all, like, they're always trying to weave their way in. And we got to just say, no, you're not here. You're not welcome. Go away.
All right, going back to the first 12 inch, was Sensible Records your guys' record company?
Yeah, that was James Sensible. That was our who's our manager. We called it Sensible Records. Yeah, we did our own records, and those were done on 2-inch analog tape. That's why they were analog tape was so expensive. So the max we could do was 6 songs. there was no digital then. It was like that. That's old school. That's like what Frank Sinatra used to record on was 2-inch analog tape.
Well, that's why it sounds so good still.
Yeah.
It's funny because the only other record that came out on Sensible Records is that Los Populeros band, that you brought up with Art Bergman's band after Young Canadians.
Oh, I love Art Bergman. Yeah. James must have done that after we fired him. So Sensible Records was strictly, and then we became Ground Zero Records, but you know, it was So yeah, I didn't know James put that up. That's great. It's James is still, I think he's with one of the CBC radio formatting things, but he was our first manager, high school kid. We were all high school kids, you know, so he was going to be our manager. And we put out that record, and it did really well. The hilarious thing was, you reach that point where you either do a second pressing or you put the money into a next record. Mm-hmm. So that was always a decision. Time to if we're gonna why put out a second pressing? Let's start working on our next record.
And were you getting outside of Toronto much at that point? Like, was there much of sort of like a touring kind of circuit?
That's a really important question, because touring was not possible for punk bands back then. So we were heavily playing basically from Windsor. We got down to Windsor as far, but London, there was punk bars. Windsor or Waterloo, Kitchener, Waterloo, Guelph, there were tons of bars to play because universities. Mm-hmm. Peterborough was a huge hotspot. We got to Montreal a number of times. But Montreal is a really was a strange town back then. And then we got a national tour, and it was with the Dub Rifles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And because the agency, which was back then the big rock agency, didn't think they could sell us across Canada. And then maybe I'm going to say something out of turn here, but the reality was once – the Dub Rifles they didn't have a great reputation in some bars because of some of the damage they'd done. So once we got on the road with them, a whole bunch of our shows got canceled. so we got to Halifax, and we were working our way back, and the Western tour fell through, and they were saying to us out west, we'd love to have you guys, but we like L'Étranger, but they were mad at the Dub Rifles, because what it taught us is Canada's a real small place.
Yeah.
What you do in one town is going to be heard in another town. Like, you don't realize that at the time, but it was a really interesting thing, because the ability to cross Canada for punk bands was so hard back then. Because again, if any of your podcast listeners or ever toured, getting out of Ontario is a hell of a thing. So the West Coast bands, they only got to Toronto just by being crazy enough to get in the bus and drive all the way. There wasn't a lot to play in between. I think by the late 80s, it had changed, and L'Étranger broke that with a national tour. Other bands like the Real Static started tour. Like when the Grievous Angels started to tour by the late 80s, we were able to play enough bars to get across the country. But the original punk scene in the early 80s, They lived in pockets where you could play a number of bars or in a couple of towns that were close by, but getting across the vast expanse of Canada. So all these kids who were like in Regina and that, they were listening to shows like Brave New Waves. They were listening to this stuff long distance, but I think the West Coast bands may have been a little more brave. They just got in the vans. I remember Subhumans coming and DOA coming and all those bands like from the West Coast. I don't know if the Young Canadians ever got as far as Toronto, but so they were growing up and they were playing really in silos, very different. They were in real hothouses of development that were where you got really different sounds coming out of different areas.
Well, I think like you said, it's it's Ontario such a nightmare to get out of that you're right. Like it's a West Coast bands, but I've never, it must've happened, but I've never seen a Teenage Head flyer for them playing any shows in like, you know, even Montreal or even Winnipeg, you know, like it's just the idea of like that, like you're saying, that first wave of Toronto punk.
I don't think any of those bands ever got outside that, you know, the corridor from, you know, Hamilton or Guelph. A couple of the West Coast bands did, and they did it just by sheer, you know, determination. By the time the Angels started touring in the late 80s, we broke it through. But one of the things that helped for us was that we got a couple of crazy shows in like Northern Ontario country bars because we had the stand up bass and the accordion, and we were just crazy enough to do it. And we had basically made gas money to get to Thunder Bay, and there was a bar in Thunder Bay. Then from Thunder Bay, it's like, I don't know, is it 12 hours to Winnipeg?
Yeah.
And then from Winnipeg, it's 12 hours to Regina. So again, if you don't have a show in between, you're going to die at the side of the road. Like Canada is not an easy place to tour. The Angels made it like it became our, you know, we were going to be road dogs. We made that tour a number of times, but it was never an easy thing to coordinate.
Oh yeah. Like how many bands have just like broken up trying to do that tour across Canada?
Yeah. I think the last L'Étranger tour, which I wasn't on at the time, I think they died in Calgary. I've never heard many of the details, but I don't think it went like, you know, your van breaks down. It's like you're getting $300 for the night. What are you going to do? It's 2000 kilometers to get home. I mean, that's why I loved a Hardcore Logo. Like it was such a great punk movie. It just, to me, it's not even a punk movie. It's just such a classic Canadian movie. It's like, this is life, folks. Like, you know, trying to get to Edmonton to play, that's, you know, in the middle of winter in February, and then the bar is closed. Like, I mean, you've seen it, you've lived that.
Oh yeah, I think we realized very early on we got to do that thing where you cut through America and just come back up into Winnipeg and do that kind of routing, because when we eventually did that cross Canada tour, you're right, there's like, there are some drives, especially if you're playing in a band that you know is loud, where you're not going to get a show for 12 hours of that drive several times on the ride across Canada.
Yeah, no, I always remember there was a bar in Hamilton, and Hamilton was funny playing because our manager, as a Toronto band, our manager said, "You're going to Hamilton. That's the big city. You're not in Toronto anymore. And you're going to have to behave yourself in the big city because they don't put up with bands to shoot their mouths off." And so we saw Hamilton was a life lesson. But I remember we had this gig at this place called the Golden Garter, which was known as the Golden Gutter. It was run by bikers. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't get the guy to call us back about a show. And we called one night, and he said, "Why are you calling me? What are you calling me for?" It's like, "Because we have a show tomorrow." And he goes, "No show, I'm leaving." It's like, "What do you mean I'm leaving?" He goes, I got to leave the country. I got to leave right now." And I was like, "Yeah, but like all our gear's there." And he goes, "I'm gone. I'm leaving." And it was like, that was life on the road, you know, like you never knew what was coming next. And
it definitely is a little.
So when I talk about punk rock university, that was punk rock university. Like, you know, like having to go with our road crew at 3 a.m. to find out where the bar owner lived, because he snuck out without paying us. Like, and you know, that $300 or $400, like we couldn't get home without it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like, that was your money. Like we couldn't pay the gas. Like we, you know, being stuck at a gas station in Manitoba, and suddenly realizing that our band manager hadn't told us that there's no money left. Well, we got 1,200 kilometers to go. How are we going to get there? You know, those are lessons about being organized and about practicing and about, you know, just taking it and saying, "Nope, we're going to get to that show. The show goes on."
I have kept you for a long time, Charlie. And would you ever come back for a part two at some point?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure. I don't think we got out of the 80s, so.
Well, no, that's the way this, I should have warned you in advance. This show moves at a snail's pace. Like we are really a very slow, but this has been incredible, because I think there's, there's almost like this sort of like you know, now especially people know about that first wave of Toronto punk rock stuff, and then people definitely know kind of like about sort of the late 80s into the 90s and sort of like the pre-can rock renaissance stuff. But the stuff that we're talking about seems almost like a forgotten time. Like there's a lot of bands, a lot of great bands that would lead to huge bands that just are kind of forgotten about, like District 17 you brought up even.
Yeah, I mean, these groups, I think it was basically where we were all going to school, and so many of those bands, so many of those players went on to become huge bands, like, you know, like Blue Rodeo. They were the High Fives. We went to see them.
Yeah.
They were sort of trying to get this alt. They then quite got the alt country thing. They were sort of doing a bit of a Beatles thing, and we were like, what are these guys doing? Then I saw Keeler on the street about a year later, and he just looked like he had it together. And that was the Blue Rodeo look. Boom. It was like they'd gone from the High Fives to, like, you know, that sort of country shirt. And then they took off. Right. And it was a school, like people were trying things out, learning things, and some lessons were learned, and some things really hit and some things really missed, but a lot of great acts came out of it.
I love that High Fives record, though. That record's incredible.
Oh, yeah. We went to see them, and we were like, yeah, what are these guys up to? And then it was like Blue Rodeo, like that transformation. Wow. How did that happen? Like, it just, boom, it there was.
Well, and the I think sort of something emblematic of that kind of period to me is that Sound of the Streets, Sound from the Streets tape compilation that you're on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I also have a weird flyer, like, was that a label? Was that a night? Like, I have a Sound from the Streets Toronto New Alternative 4 nights flyer at the Rivoli.
Okay, you need Dave McIntosh on your show.
Funny about that.
No, he's running a little cafe up in the Highlands of Scotland now. But Dave, his name was Dave Rave back in the day. But Dave Rave organized Sounds from the Streets, and he is the encyclopedia of that whole sound time and all those bands. He is very faithful to that. He organized it. He ran a zine. Again, zines were what we, you know, we didn't have an internet. We had fanzines. Mm-hmm. Sounds from the Street actually was attempting to say, let's coalesce this sound into something that we can actually make and package and promote as a distinct thing. So yeah, on a future show, you'll have to have Dave Rave on, Dave McIntosh. He is the memory of a lot of this stuff. He loves it. He's never forgotten of things.
I think I have a Dave Rave single. He put out records too, right?
No.
Is that a different Dave Rave? Maybe
I don't know. Maybe not him singing, but he was active with people.
It's funny, because like it seems like it would be a really hard thing to package. Like, you look at Discord Records, you look at, you know, even the stuff we're talking about on the West Coast scene with like Frontier Records or SST Records. Like, you know, that's very easy to kind of market and package someone, because sonically they're all in the same wheelhouse. But Sounds of the Streets, you've got Yourselves, Youth, Rent Boys, like it's something for everybody.
Yeah, I think that was one of the interesting things about the Toronto scene and one of the problems of it. I don't think it packaged all that well. It wasn't that distinct, like Vancouver sound or LA sound. There was a lot of people doing really, really different stuff. And then there were just really out there marginal acts. Like, I've been thinking a lot about Maya Bannerman, who I've never heard of. Like, she was just this really strange voice, like kind of like a Jane Sibri, and she sang beautiful songs. And like, you'd go to a show and there'd be like someone like a Jane Sibri.
Yeah.
Almost like, you know, a Joni Mitchell type. And then there'd be like the CDs or, you know, a punk band on. It was a real mix. It was, again, I think it was a lot of stuff was being bubbling up and coming to a level where, and, you know, ended up with like, you know, Mary Margaret O'Hara and like a lot of those definitive Toronto albums that came out from that was bubbling up out of those Sounds from the Streets kind of things.
You mentioned zines, and obviously you go on to publish a magazine. Did you do a zine back in the day, or were zines informative on you back then?
Well, zines were I mean, we lived with zines. We were more interested in getting our picture in one than writing one. yeah, the zines, there was this, what was her name? I'm drawing a blank now. She was about 14. She ran a really interesting zine. A music fan, 14, 15 year old, ran her zine.
Was right? it Dr. Like, Smith, maybe, was it called? Or
I can't remember.
Okay, I will try to figure this out.
I have a cover with us, Adamant, and the Young Lions on one of her zines. But anyways,
Dinah, what a lineup!
I know, but like the zines were like you would go down to the record stores and buy these like little photocopied things that people would put out, and they were homemade, and they would interview bands, and you know they would faithfully transcribe our dumb, incoherent mutterings, and then fans would read them and then quote them back to us. So the zines were, yeah, that was part of it. It was posters, it was music, you know, again, places like Ottawa or Kitchener where you had a radio station that could be heard outside the university that actually played bands. That was how it all was done. And then shows like, I think it was, what was the show on CBC that played at late at 11 o'clock at night with Augusta Page?
No, not Brayton. Okay, sorry, yeah.
She had her show at like 11 o'clock at night. And if you got on that show, kids in Regina heard you. Otherwise, nobody heard you. The other big element was much music. Much music.
Yeah.
You know, we used to make fun of JD and Jeannie Becker, but like, they broke all, like any band. If you got on much music, you were real. So there you go. That was the extent of the culture in CFNY.
We brought that Dick Kennedy show. When I worked there, I went to the archives and they shot that show, the whole show, with three cameras. Like who else was putting the Dick Kennedys on TV back then?
I know. And that show was that was mayhem. Like that wouldn't have been on today. Like nobody would have covered that.
No,
they covered the Dead Kennedys. You know, there's my 14-year-old brother. There's one of the only road crews trying to like stop Nazis from jumping a Jello, and it's like, and it's on TV. Like, that was the times.
Oh, well, this has been the time of my life for me. Anytime you want to come back here, Charlie, and talk about
let's do this. Like, well, give me a subject next time and we'll talk. Well, I could talk forever. So, this was fun because I've been thinking a little bit about that time, and I think it's a lot more, there's a lot of things to think about. There was an interesting gelling. So this has been a blast.
Thank you, Charlie, for coming on the show. And I don't speak just for myself when I say this. I think I speak for Charlie, too. Get out there right now and get yourself informed about all the issues that are going on here in Canada right now, if you're able to vote in our next election, because we have an election coming up on Monday, September 20th. So get out there right now, get informed, and go vote. Go vote. And Charlie will be back for part two at some point in the near future. I cannot wait for that. Speaking of not being able to wait, I cannot wait for you to hear the next episode of Turn Out of Punk, because the next episode of Turn Out of Punk is another one that I thought lost. This is a meeting of the minds of epic proportions. One of the greatest episodes ever is the Tony Molina episode, where Tony Molina comes on the show. Well, Tony Molina is back, returning with Turn Out of Punk family member Nick Woge, and these two have never met before, and they come together, and I don't know, I really felt like a matchmaker making something happen here. These people just hit it off, and you will hear it all in all its glory on the next episode of the show. Well, that's it. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous peoples matter. We need to protect trans kids, and we need to help trans people protect themselves. We need to stop hate and violence towards Asian people and people of different faiths. And just this isn't political. As I say each and every week, these aren't political issues. Like this stuff has nothing to do with an election. This is just basic human rights shit. So as I say, you know, go out there and get yourself informed. Read about what's happening in this world. If there's organizations that are doing work in an area that you feel strongly about, support those organizations. If there's protests or demonstrations, go and lend your support to that too. Lend financial support if you can. Like do what you can. But at the end of the day, we just need to say, fuck off to this Nazi shit. Fuck off to this fascist shit, because it's a non-starter. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you're not going to need them. You're just going to be like, shit, this is just taking up more space as I'm dying. So get them out of me. Give someone else the gift of life, potentially. It does. I've seen it. I've seen it with my own eyes. So, you know, go out there and make your own culture. Anyone can do this shit. Start a band, start a fanzine. You heard Charlie, you know, start a band. Next thing you know, maybe you're going to be a member of parliament. Maybe you're going to be able to help change the world and make the world a better place. Who knows? You know, you could all just start. You don't have to even start a band. You just start, draw a picture for yourself. Just do anything, something creative for yourself. Try meditating. I didn't believe in it, and I try it, and it works. And for me, maybe it'll work for you, you know? All right, I think that's it. Stay safe, everyone. I look forward to hopefully seeing you all again in person. And I will see you on the next episode. Thank you very much for listening. Bye.